Silver Sound, helping you to ease your way gently into the day.
Slow down, you move too fast. You got to make the morning last. Just kicking down the cobblestones.
Are we being manipulated and controlled and guided into a new world order and a new world religion? Yes. Is there a group in charge of this who's been in charge all along who are bringing this about? Yes. And I can tell you, folks, they're as old as man. They are the followers of an ancient religion that has persisted even unto this day.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Curious case of the MKO. Is the US happy to train terrorists so long as they're blowing up Iranians? Thirty-five years ago this week, one of the most horrific terrorist attacks ever, killing a president, a prime minister and several cabinet ministers when a suitcase blew up when it was opened in their faces. The terror group is still active and the US removed the MKO from terrorist lists. They're now being trained by the West for further terrorist attacks against Iran and Iranian people. Plus, the small matter of China moving into Syria and now formally backing Bashar al-Assad. Also, survivors of Chile's Nazi paedophile torture compound, Colonia Dignidad, have been speaking out. But who put Pinochet in place? We hear from the horse's mouth, the CIA's deputy director at the time, Tom Braden. Also, astroturfing. Why haven't Wikipedia acted to stop big corporations and powerful individuals spinning their own Wikipedia pages and erasing embarrassing misdeeds? And to mark back to school week, Monday, a real brain teaser. The old Confederate General's letter, covered by the Daily Mail and the Express now too, which suggests World Wars 1 and 2, as well as a coming World War 3 between Islam and Zionism, were all planned by this senior general 200 years ago. Our sister show Dialects back at noon every Tuesday. This week, the first ever interview with Michael Tyler. You just heard from just before the news there, who's a full interview with him, who compiled a definitive list of bankers who've died mysteriously since 2006 and the 2008 bailouts. There are about 70 on his list. Also, nearly 250 Germans have been on a two-week friendship mission from Berlin to Moscow and back, covered in the Russian news, the TV, the radio and the newspapers, but the German TV sent a reporter along and they never reported a thing about the tour. That's Dialect at noon next Tuesday. But let's start this week, Martin, with something from the news bulletins. It's kind of putting you on the spot here, but we've had this arrest down in Somerset near Yeovil of a Royal Marine who it looks as if has been involved in some kind of terrorist incident to do with Northern Ireland, and there are parts of his home here in Somerset and in Northern Ireland that have been searched by the police. Some army munitions found that it seems that he may have taken, and also possibly even homemade explosive devices. Now, this is really worrying, as this seems to be a serving officer. A serving soldier.
Yeah, well, I mean, we don't know the full detail of this. I think they discovered an arms cache in County Antrim, and which had homemade bomb making equipment and Claymore mines in it. And I believe the Claymore.
Can you just tell us what is a Claymore mine?
Well, I'm not really sure, to be honest with you, Tony. It's a kind of a mine, but the point about it is it's a British Army standard issue mine. And the question when the police found this arms cache was, where did they get these mines from? And I think that's what's led back to this guy being arrested.
Also, he's actually been charged now with terror offences. 30-year-old Royal Marine from Northern Ireland appears in court charged with terror offence related to dissident republicanism. I mean, is it possible that the army have is there any track record of this kind of links between the army and dissident republicans? It sounds like a impossible, really, because surely they're both on the opposite sides of this conflict.
Well, look, I mean, many IRA activists were ex-British Army soldiers from the very beginning of the Troubles onwards. And it looks to me as if he may have been encouraged to join the army by his real IRA handlers.
And we don't know. Does it happen the other way around? Do the army ever try and infiltrate these groups?
Of course, that's been going on all along.
And how well is that controlled? I mean, is the infiltration just gathering evidence, or do they sometimes kind of almost go...
Well, look, I mean, there was Donal McIntyre's Panorama documentary, which was about this time last year, it came out, I believe, was covering the whole murky tale of the role of the British Army's Force Research Unit in Northern Ireland. And, Nuala O'Loan, who's the police ombudswoman, is quoted in the film as saying, well, we've got direct evidence that the British Army have been involved in the culling of hundreds of civilians in Northern Ireland.
Well, today, Kieran Maxwell has been charged with the following offences between 1st of January 2011 and 21st of August 2016, with the intention of assisting another to commit acts of terrorism engaged in conflict in preparation for giving effect to this intention, namely research resulting in the creation of a library of documents providing information of a kind likely to be useful to a person committing or preparing acts of terrorism. Information regarding the manufacture of explosive substances, the construction of explosive devices and tactics used by terror organisations. Also, he's been charged with purchasing or otherwise obtaining articles for a purpose connected with the commission, preparation or instigation of an act of terrorism, chemicals and components to be used in the manufacture of explosive substances, construction, and also an image of an adapted Police Service of Northern Ireland pass card, items from a PSNI uniform. Also, he's been charged with manufacturing explosive substances, constructing explosive devices, creating and maintaining hides in England and Northern Ireland to store explosive substances, components for explosive devices, ammunition, weapons, tools and resources. And this does seem to be a pretty long catalogue. There are two other charges as well. One is in the 24th of August, a possession of a quantity of controlled drugs, namely cannabis, with intent to supply, and also in possession of articles, bank cards and associated CVC numbers for use in connection with fraud. So the main charge clearly is the first one of terrorism, and it just seemed like he was, that this will obviously all come out in court, but he may have been actually part of a terrorist gang whilst a serving British soldier.
Well, I mean, what's unusual about this is that he's part of a terrorist gang on the Republican side, whereas, of course, in actual fact, the collusion between, in particular, the Ulster Defence Regiment and the Loyalist paramilitaries is much, much more common.
And is it not impossible that he may have been infiltrating this gang, and that's why he had this equipment?
Listen, I don't know is the simple answer
What I'm saying is there any track record of this kind of thing happening? Like the British Army?
If he'd been infiltrating on behalf of the army, then they wouldn't be being charged, would he? It's an unusual case in one way, but I mean, as I come back to the point I made earlier, the investigations by the Northern Ireland Police Ombudswoman have shown that the British Army's Force Research Unit, operating in Belfast and across the six counties during the Troubles, was directly responsible for the murder of hundreds of civilians. I repeat that, directly responsible. You've got, and people, when there was a ceasefire and an agreement, it wasn't just the IRA who had to cease fire. The British Army had to cease fire as well. And of course, the difference between IRA activists who get 25 years in prison for killing people and British Army officers like Brigadier Gordon Kerr, who's the head of the Force Research Unit, is that they don't go to prison.
Well, let's go straight from Antrim to Tehran, and Iran is marking the anniversary of the 1981 bombing at the then Prime Minister's office in the Islamic Republic of Iran. Their President Mohammad al-Rajai and then Prime Minister Mohammad Javad Bahonar lost their lives in a bombing in the capital, Tehran, 35 years ago today. The Islamic Republic of Iran is marking that anniversary, and the list of those cabinet ministers as well. Three cabinet ministers, survivors said an aide identified as Massoud Kashmiri had brought a briefcase into the conference room, placed it in the two high-ranking Iranian political figures, and then left. An explosion occurred when one of the victims opened the briefcase. The blast killed three other members of the Islamic Republican Party, as well as the two key people in the government, the Prime Minister and the President, Martin.
Yes, well, MKO, who carried out the bombing, I think they used to be known as MEK. They're a very strange actors.
Mujahideen El-Kak organisation, known as MKO and MEK as well.
Yeah, well, they're a pretty sinister outfit with a rather cultish leader, and they were basically came out of the Iranian Revolution. They were Islamist Marxists was their original orientation. I remember reading some of their literature years ago, but of course they've been taken up by Western powers as a means of putting pressure on the Iranian government. And just like the British Army's Force Research Unit in Northern Ireland carrying out acts of terrorism, British and US intelligence services quite happily cooperate with terrorists across the planet.
Tehran's Friday prayers leader Ayatollah Khatami, he's saying, I mean, I don't know whether this is true or not, but he's saying that the MKO has the darkest record before the Iranian nation, as the terrorist group has carried out 17,000 assassinations against innocent people as part of its criminal record. And what he's really annoyed about is that certain governments are chanting the slogan of campaign against terrorism, but actually actively supporting the MKO still to this day, indicating their agenda is not human rights and confronting terrorism at all.
No, and it's similar to what's been going on in Syria, where the Western powers and their Gulf allies have been happily arming and training the most extreme terrorists you could possibly imagine.
It seems that special forces are often in these countries without any sanction of parliament as well, up to no good, and training up possible terrorists in those countries. Well, so whereabouts do you think in the Middle East, could there be some of our soldiers, special forces in Iran even?
It's quite likely that people are infiltrated into Iran. And of course, we know that British special forces are operating from Jordan and into the north, the southern part of Syria, and they're operating in Libya, and of course they're operating with terrorists. They arm and train these terrorists. The Al-Nusra Front has changed its name in northern Syria to the something else, Sham Front.
The Sham Liberation Front.
The Sham Liberation Army, or whatever they're now called.
Sham Liberation Front.
Front. And, of course, by changing their name, they're suddenly no longer Al-Qaeda, which is what they were originally. And now the Americans have supplied them with missiles that can take down planes and tanks. Wonderful.
Also, staying with that region, China has entered the fray in Syria on Bashar al-Assad's side. This is the Irish Times, but I've hardly seen any reporting of this. This is the thing I find so amazing nowadays. A massive story like China bringing its people into Syria to try and prop up the government of Bashar al-Assad is a massive move. I mean, these are not small stories. This is what's going on here is countries that are part of the Security Council have not been able to settle their difference in the Security Council, so they're sending their various troops from these various Security Council countries into Syria.
Well, don't forget the Chinese have got a vested interest in this, because operating within Syria are Uyghur military formations, which have been trained and armed by the Turks because they speak a Turkic language. And they are also behind terrorist attacks inside China itself in Xinjiang province. And, the Chinese, if they go and intervene in Syria, it will be to try and, one of the reasons will be to try and, counteract these people. Because, of course, by fighting in Syria, they're getting all the expertise and experience that they can take back into China. That's another reason why the Russians are intervening, because they can see these people coming. There's lots of Chechens fighting in Syria, for example. In fact, most of the armed groups operating in the anti-government side are not made up of Syrians at all. And, of course, that's all been orchestrated by our friends in the intelligence services.
I mean, they call them advisors that they're sending in there. They're helping out the military. Obviously, if the Chinese government is sending in some of their military people.
They're just sending advisors, as far as I know, at this stage.
But an advisor is often trained people, and they're often militarily trained. I'm just amazed at the lack of coverage here, really, because you look at, for example, the only thing I could see anywhere in the press in our part of the world was in the Financial Times. It says Chinese foreign policy throwing out the rule book.
One of the things that the standoff in the South China Sea, which has been precipitated by the Americans pushing the Philippines to take the Chinese to the International Court in The Hague to get a ruling against them. It's bizarre because they were taken to a court of arbitration, and the basic principle of arbitration is that both sides have got to agree to it. So the Chinese said, well, we're not going to agree to it. We don't want to go to arbitration. But the Americans have forced the Filipinos to go to arbitration. And it's them that have been stirring this up from behind the scenes. It's what they sometimes call lead from behind. And of course, the Chinese are not very happy with it. It's provocative. It's annoying them. So the way they respond is by popping up in Syria.
I just like to say, well done to the Irish Times, being just about the only people in the entire British Isles to actually had a look at this very important issue. They're saying that Moscow, Beijing, and Tehran have serious reasons for backing Damascus. Russian and Chinese ties go to Syria go back to the Cold War, when the Soviet Union, the People's Republic of China, supported and armed the Arabs against Israel. Iran and Syria became allies in 1980 following the establishment of the Islamic Republic. Now, that's just before this big bomb attack that we were being told about here. So basically, when the Iranians kicked out the Americans from Iran in 1979, it seems that the Russians and the Chinese were straight into the region and particularly saw Syria as an important point to bolster. How's this all going to end up, though, Martin? Because you've now got the Americans in, you've got the British in, you've got the Turks in, you've got the Chinese in, and you've got the Russians all in Syria.
Well, there's a potential here for miscalculation, which will lead to outright fighting between NATO forces and Russian, Syrian and Iranian forces. It's just about been avoided so far, but there's no guarantee that we will continue to avoid such conflict.
So what happens if, say, the Russians shoot down an American aircraft, or the British shoot down a Russian plane, for example? Because obviously the air power and control of the air is one of the major things that some of the people, ordinary people like ISIS, etc., are running around on the ground. But air power is where it all happens, isn't it?
It is, and of course the Americans have been supplying the so-called moderate Al-Qaeda rebels in Syria with ground-to-air missiles. But nevertheless, it seems that they're not as effective as they used to be, because the Russians' countermeasures are actually quite good. Back in the 80s, when they were supplying Stinger missiles to the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, they were able to basically force the Russians out, because they couldn't bring in air support, and helicopters were very vulnerable to these things. But it looks as if the latest generation of Russian aircraft are not as vulnerable as they previously were.
So do you think NATO's on a hiding to nothing, trying to oust Assad?
Well, what's really sad about all of this is the war could come to an end if Assad and his allies were allowed to win it. I mean, Aleppo is the last stand of the terrorists, or whatever you want to call them. They don't actually control most of the population in Aleppo. Most of the population has fled to the government-controlled areas, and about 70% of the population of Syria is in government-controlled areas. And the areas controlled by the so-called rebels, most people have fled from those areas because it's intolerable circumstances. In the long run, when the history comes to be written, the perfidious role that's been played, particularly by the British government in this conflict, will have to be addressed. But I mean, if we're going to send down Royal Marines who are planning terrorism in Northern Ireland, maybe we should send some of our top intelligence people to prison, because they do seem to be supporting terrorism, including Al Qaeda terrorism.
Well, and possibly police too. British police have been criticised this week for lack of transparency in the Bahrain training deal. This is Kevin Rawlinson in The Guardian. British police have been criticised because they refused to release details of an international deal to train security officials from Bahrain, country accused of a litany of human rights abuses. Human rights campaigners have said the College of Policing, which sets standards for UK officers and offers worldwide training courses, should be compelled to explain their work in countries with bad records of civil liberties. Concerns come less than 2 months after MPs criticised the totally unacceptable opacity around the college's provision of training to Saudi Arabia. This is pretty pernicious, isn't it? We're training what effectively are two, I think it's fair to say police states here.
Yes, indeed. And of course, the other thing that people may not realise is that we're going to open a new British naval base in Bahrain, the locals don't want it, but Bahrain was a British colony until 1971, when it was then handed over to the Khalifa family by the British. And Saudi Arabia invaded during 2011, and they came straight over the causeway and put down the Shia democracy protesters. And we are implicated in all of that. We're implicated in it all completely.
Yes, I seem to remember that police officer John Yates, who interviewed Tony Blair over cash for questions and then disappeared off to Bahrain to help train. So it does seem to there's this kind of relationship there. I mean, is it fair to train anybody in policing, no matter if they're a kind of police state regime? And we're making some money out of this, apparently £8.6 million.
The simple answer to that is no. No, it's not. They shouldn't be doing it. Why are they doing it? And, of course, the British police officers are operating in Bahrain up to now. Unlike in Syria, the opposition in Bahrain hasn't resorted to armed struggle. But if they were to do so, they'd have exactly the same right as people in Syria. In fact, more, because the people in Syria are not supported by the majority of the population. But I understand that the opposition in Bahrain is not prepared to go to war, but if they were, and they were to kill some of these police officers who are doing the training, well, I'm afraid that would be that, wouldn't it? That's what this is all about. If you want to get your finger into that sort of mess, then you could end up with a bullet in the back of the head, couldn't you?
Staying with the Middle East, Tel Aviv has just approved 463 settlement homes yesterday in the occupied lands. Israel approved Wednesday construction of 463 homes for settlers in the occupied West Bank. The watchdog Peace Now has said the move drew sharp rebuke from the US. Washington said it was deeply concerned by the announcement, with senior US officials slamming the pervasive advancement of settlement activity in a new and potentially unlimited way. Approvals mostly included new housing units, but a retroactive green light was also granted to 179 existing homes in the Ofarim settlement. Around 50 new units received final approval. Benjamin Netanyahu, Israeli Prime Minister, continues to plan and build all over the West Bank, whilst also giving settlers the message that any construction done without planning will be retroactively legalised, Peace Now said.
Well, you've got to ask yourself the question, why is Israel still a member of the United Nations? If they're not prepared to play by the rules, they should be booted out of the club. And we can discuss whether we're going to recognise Kosovo or not. If we can discuss that, we can discuss why is Israel, a country about the same size as Kosovo, why have they got a seat at the United Nations? Perhaps they shouldn't have one.
And why are the Americans continuing to supply them with fantastic amounts of money and arms, etc.? They're saying that they think this is they're deeply concerned, this is a rebuke from US officials, but no real action. I mean, do they mean it, the Americans, when they say that they shouldn't do this?
Well, they're going through the motions. They feel as if they have to say something, because it should become, if they don't say something, then they look as if they're completely biased, which in fact they generally are. And of course, what happens is the Israelis get massive amounts of money. I mean, every Israeli citizen is subsidised to the tune of several thousand dollars per head per year by the US taxpayer. And in other words, the potential for making them behave themselves is quite big. If that subsidy was withdrawn, lots of the people living in Israel, including in the occupied territories, might decide that they were better off going back to the United States of America, where most of them were born. But they stay in Israel because they're subsidised by the US taxpayer to do so. Is that a viable or sensible strategy? No, it's not. And I'm afraid, the running sore that is what's going on there just adds to the general chaos and tension in the region, doesn't it?
Also staying with the Israelis, an Israeli fugitive tech titan by the name of Kobe Alexander has been jailed in New York. Now, he's someone that we've mentioned on this show a couple of times, years gone by, Martin, but he's kind of fallen off the radar. Kobe Alexander was the chief executive of a company called Converse Infosys, which was back in 2001, December 2001, just after the 9/11 attacks, accused of spying in the United States. A very interesting report by Fox News reporter Carl Cameron into that. I mean, basically what they were doing is they were supplying the telephone records and paper records of people's phone calls, but then they were also being linked to the Israeli Secret Service. So they went along to the phone companies in the US and said, we can provide you a very cheap way of printing out all your phone bills and sending them to people, etc. The phone companies said fine, but then they were using all this information basically as a foreign intelligence service who'd managed to infiltrate the United States. But anyway, he was running that company, but he wasn't content with doing that spying. He also was doing what's called stock option backdating. So that meant that he was saying that he bought stock options retrospectively after the event, when he knew that that was the best time to have bought it, and he didn't actually buy them at all. So he made vast amounts of money personally, and he's agreed now to pay back $60 million to Comverse in connection with this litigation, and to waive over $72 million in claims that he had against the company. So this is basically a guy who's been running around the world on the run from the Securities and Exchange Commission in the US, in charge of a very important and powerful Israeli firm. But more than that, Comverse Infosys is the company that owns a British company. Well, it's actually based in Israel, but it's a British company that was involved in the 7/7 London bombings. At least it was the security company that was involved just before in having the tube security cameras being privatized a few months before the bombings. His company was running that contract. So it's a lot of questions about this guy, this company, and Israeli tech in this story.
Well, yes. And the Israeli high tech security complex, when you've privatized security at airports, for example, many Western airports are actually run, the security is actually run by a private Israeli firm linked to Mossad called ICTS. And of course, the suspicion is that many of the attacks in airports, like 9/11 and in Brussels and so on, are being facilitated, let's put it that way, by ICTS. They were in charge of Schiphol Airport, for example, when the so-called underpants bomber was led onto the plane with no shoes on and no passport, without going through any security check. As Kurt Haskell, who was a lawyer on the plane, has given eyewitness statements.
But what I mean, more to the point, what is London Underground doing, employing, giving a contract to a firm whose parent company's chief executive, who's fled to Namibia for 10 years, having absconded with $33 million of his own company's money, and he won't go back to America now? He's just gone back just now, 10 years afterwards, to face one charge. Obviously, a deal has been done where previously he was going to be facing 35 charges. Why are companies like this being employed in this country, or contracts being given to them, when the chief executive of the parent company quite clearly is a crook?
Well, it's because this Israeli security complex, Comverse Systems, ICTS, etc., are worming their way. They're using the privatisation process in order to get themselves into positions of, extremely powerful positions running security and CCTV. And the suspicion is, I'm afraid, that the Israeli secret services are terrorists.
It does look
they use the positions that they've created in order to facilitate various terrorist attacks, which are then blamed on Islamists.
It does look as if the Americans have been quite subtle about this, in a way, in that they've used the stock option backdating rap to get this guy for what his company's been doing, stealing information from people's phone records. So they obviously didn't want that to be made a massive public scandal, so they found something else to get him for. This guy's the chief executive here in Britain was Daniel Bodner. He was running Verint Systems, who were the company that was doing the London Underground contract, and Bodner was trained in explosives by the Israeli army. So you do wonder whether there was any kind of motive there for the Israelis grabbing this London Underground contract with a company run by an expert in explosives, and why they weren't kind of questioned in any of the process after the London bombings.
Well, as you know, Benjamin Netanyahu, who was the finance minister of Israel, he was supposed to go to a meeting at Liverpool Street that morning, and he didn't go. and the Times of Israel phoned up the Israeli embassy after the bombing and said, "Do we want to find out if Bibi's okay, because we understand he was supposed to go to a meeting this morning where one of these bombs went off." And they said, "Don't worry, it's okay, we had a warning," and he didn't leave the building. Now, if I was in charge of the investigation into the 7/7 bombings, I would have immediately surrounded the Israeli embassy, cut off the electricity and the water, and said to them, "Right, you tell us where you got your warning from. Where did you get a warning?"
And maybe Dan Shaham, that's Dan Shehaam, would have given you an answer, because he was the Israeli spokesperson we revealed exclusively on this show a few years ago on one of the 7/7 anniversaries. He was the Israeli spokesperson at the embassy that had given that information to various journalists that morning, saying that we had a warning around about 8 a.m, over an hour before the bombs actually went off on 7/7. Very few people know that, and it seems there's been no proper investigation into the potential Israeli embassy involvement in those bombs. Anyway, next story, the bizarre media blackout of hacked George Soros documents. Leaked documents released this last week provide juicy insider details of how a fabulously rich businessman has been using his money to influence elections in Europe and underwrite an extremist group. Also, target US citizens who disagree with him, dictate foreign policy and try to sway a Supreme Court ruling. Pretty compelling stuff, right? Not if it involves leftist billionaire George Soros. In this case, the mainstream press couldn't care less, says Tyler Durden at Zero Hedge. On Saturday, a group called DC Leaks posted more than 2,500 documents going back to 2008 that it got from George Soros' Open Society Foundation service. Since then, the mainstream media have shown zero interest in this goldmine of information. Sounds like a kind of mini WikiLeaks, Martin, but why haven't the... He's quite right. He's saying there's no stories in the New York Times, CNN, Washington Post, CBS or other major Western news sites that even noted the existence of these leaked documents, let alone reported on what's on them. So who is this guy George Soros, and what's he doing with these 90 different financial grants to various organisations that are trying to fix elections during 2014, just for one example?
Well, he's a very powerful individual with a very, an explicit agenda.
Is he powerful enough to tell the London media, "No, I don't want you to report on these leaks"?
Yeah, pretty much. Don't forget, he provides a lot of funds to a lot of different people. And if you were to cross him, then maybe he wouldn't provide you with the resources that you wanted. So that obviously people tread very carefully around him. I mean, he was very much involved in the coup in the Ukraine. So a lot of the things he funds have a sort of superficially progressive character. Although I would suggest that any progressives who take Soros's money need to take a very long spoon.
Well, one of these grants,
but in the Ukraine, he's taken a much more kind of essentially hawkish line.
One of these grants, for example, is $200,000 to conduct a major smear campaign against conservative activists. In October 2015, a document came to light showing that his Open Society programs donated $650,000 to invest in technical assistance and support for groups at the burgeoning Black Lives Matter movement. Since then, several Black Lives Matter protests have turned violent. The same document details how this group successfully used its extensive networks to pressurize the Obama administration into increasing the number of refugees it would take to 100,000, despite concerns that Islamic terrorists could use the refugee program to infiltrate the US. So it does seem as if that there are lots of these little NGOs out there that could survive without this guy. But he's basically kind of creating loads of these little sock puppet organizations which are quietly being funded by him. I mean, of course, you know, people do need a job, they do need a living, and it would be nice if George Soros would knock on our door, actually, Martin, and say, "Here's a £600,000 grant for your radio show." But he's not going to do that, is he? He's interested in creating almost a kind of civil society opposition right across the Western world.
Yeah, and obviously very, very much involved in what went on in Eastern Europe and elsewhere.
And he's also
the Arab Spring and so forth.
Quite a lot of groups in Russia in order to try and overthrow Putin.
He's found it more difficult to operate in Russia because the Russians got fed up with you can't just have people funding the stuff which is designed to destabilise your country. You know, you've got to have some rules about that. You can't just, I mean, for example, you can't have anybody just turning up in Britain and spending any amount of money on our elections.
Well, one person that did report on this is Breitbart News, Chris Tomlinson, and he's saying that the left-wing think tank that released a controversial report about Islamophobia on Twitter was directly funded by George Soros's Open Society Foundation. Demos released a new report that conflates Islamophobia with any criticism of Islam. It claimed on Friday, a couple of weeks ago, that Islamophobic tweets had become so frequent that Twitter should actively engage in censorship to stop the comments. Leaked documents from the Open Society Foundation show George Soros's organisation funded Demos to conduct this research over social media platforms like Twitter. So this is effectively lobbying for this report, which then gets becomes almost like mainstream news, and people use it to try and pretend to governments and to policymakers, and I suppose to executives at Twitter, that something needs to be done.
Well, I mean, far be it from me to defend Islamophobia on Twitter. I mean, what's very unsettling about Soros is some of the things that he believes in are generally progressive ideas, but it's still something deeply suspicious and worrying when somebody's got such a strong agenda like that. And as I say, in the Ukraine in particular, far from pursuing a progressive agenda, George Soros has very much been in favour of supporting what are basically neo-Nazis to overthrow the Yanukovych regime.
It does make you wonder when you see a report whether it's just one of these kind of Soros-funded or someone else has funded it, and there's an agenda and a whole bunch of load of money behind it, whether it's in any kind of way journalistically balanced and honest.
Well, I think in a sense, you've got, as long as people say where they're getting their money from, they're entitled to have some money to do reports, aren't they? But they've got to tell us where the money comes from.
A lot of the time they don't, and that this is it leaked in leaks like this, which are then not reported, because I suppose in a way it's embarrassing for big organisations like the BBC that say 10 or 20 of their stories over the last month have just been funded by Soros.
Indeed. And I think, obviously, he's in the sights of conservative activists in the US. And, of course, it's not just Soros, of course. You've got Sheldon Adelson and the Koch brothers and other various billionaires, what Bernie Sanders calls the billionaire class. They are basically, you know, they buy everything that's not nailed down. And that's where we're at. I mean, the democracy is a pretty threadbare thing, isn't it?
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
On to take a look at the US presidential elections. Been chugging along. We do touch on it from week to week, but I thought we'd have a pretty good look this week, Martin, because both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump have been speaking to something called the American Legion this week about US foreign policy. Who are the American Legion, and why is this significant in the race to be president?
Well, they're roughly equivalent to the Royal British Legion over here. So it's basically people, ex-members of the US Armed Forces make up the American Legion.
But why is it important?
Well, it's seen as a key demographic that, you know, that politicians want to persuade.
Sort of former servicemen and servicewomen. So anyway, let's have a listen first of all now to, it was over 2 days, and the first into the traps was Hillary Clinton. So let's have a listen to what she was saying about her intentions for US foreign policy into the future, speaking to the American Legion this week.
Let's modernize our Army and Marines, our Navy and Air Force, our Coast Guard. We need to respond to evolving threats from states like Russia and China, Iran and North Korea, from networks, criminal and terrorist networks like ISIS. We need a military that is ready and agile so it can meet the full range of threats and operate on short notice across every domain, not just land, sea, air and space, but also cyberspace. We'll invest in new technologies so new breakthroughs can transform our military, just as stealth, precision weapons and advanced communications did in the past. We'll make a renewed push to reduce the world's nuclear weapons, because that does make us all safer. And we'll step up our efforts to secure nuclear material around the world and stop terrorists from acquiring or using weapons of mass destruction. One of the first things I will do as president is to call for a new nuclear posture review. We have to make sure that America's arsenal is prepared to meet future threats. We'll invest in the next frontier of military engagement, protecting U.S. interests in outer space and cyberspace. You've seen reports. Russia's hacked into a lot of things. China's hacked into a lot of things. Russia even hacked into the Democratic National Committee. Maybe even some state election systems. So we've got to step up our game. Make sure we are well defended and able to take the fight to those who go after us. As president, I will make it clear that the United States will treat cyber attacks just like any other attack. We will be ready with serious political, economic, and military responses. And we're going to invest in protecting our governmental networks and our national infrastructure. I want us to lead the world in setting the rules of cyberspace. If America doesn't, others will. So in short, we have to be ready to win today's fights and tomorrow's.
Well, she's hinting there, Martin, that with a cyber attack against the United States, she would be prepared to retaliate with military force.
Yes, extremely worrying. And of course,
she's effectively saying that this is the infrastructure of the United States, and it can't function without its little internet cyber stuff. So if someone's having a go, then they're quite within their rights to have a go back.
Indeed. And it's sort of, if you remember, the United States and the Israelis created together the Stuxnet virus, which was designed to mess up the Natanz nuclear reactor in Iran. But that Stuxnet virus then transferred itself into the general cyberspace and probably played some role in what happened at Fukushima. How irresponsible is it for a nation state like the United States to deliberately create viruses which are designed to cripple crucial infrastructure in foreign countries? I think that's there's one rule for them and another rule for everybody else, isn't it?
Well, Jan Stoltenberg, who's Secretary General of NATO, he said just after this year's Bilderberg meeting, which we covered and I was over at in Dresden, this is the main political NATO zone lobby by big business, bankers and royalty, basically run the Western world pretty much, it seems, but he's saying a massive cyber attack could trigger a NATO response. So it seems that Hillary Clinton is absolutely in line with what NATO are saying about this, and that the next question, which neither of them have asked, is how, when there is some kind of cyber attack, how you identify where it's come from. And we're talking about things like a cyber attack on our electricity infrastructure, possibly gas infrastructure. The Internet of Things has opened all of our worlds, including not just our PCs, but much of our crucial infrastructure now, up to hackers. We're talking even about aircraft and cars too.
Well, also, of course, there's a potential for the terrorist mastermind sitting inside the intelligence services to fake a cyber attack, as perhaps to cover up a stock market crash or something of that sort. Say the stock market crashes, they can say, well, that wasn't the stock market crashing, that was the Chinese hacking into the Wall Street computers, and it's not our fault, look over there. All of these things are possible because of the belligerent stance which Hillary Clinton was pretty much outlining in that speech. She's basically saying, when I am president, we are going to be on a confrontational course with Russia, China and Iran.
Well, she mentioned also the Democratic National Council, didn't she, and they're being apparently hacked by the Russians too.
Well, there's no evidence that the Russians... I mean, what the evidence suggests that insiders in the Democratic National Council, is it, rather than the convention, were very unhappy with the way she stole
Democratic
the nomination.
National Committee, I think, yeah, exactly, is it? Committee, DNC,
yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, I mean, but there's lots of evidence to suggest that Hillary Clinton basically stole the Democratic nomination through various shenanigans, basically fixing the vote, and the DNC acting basically as a facilitator, which is why Debbie Wasserman Schultz had to resign. And the people who may have leaked it, I mean, Julian Assange has said it's not the Russians that were giving us this stuff. I can tell you that categorically, and he should know because he's the recipient, and he's hinted as broadly as he can that he thinks that this chap, I've forgotten his name now, who was murdered, in supposed robbery, where they didn't bother to take his phone or his wallet. He was actually in charge of the IT for the DNC, and it seems that likely to me that he's the source of the leaks, because he was so unhappy with the way Clinton was basically stealing the election. And of course she's now diverted attention from what's in those emails by saying this is outrageous, the Russians have done this because they're trying to undermine me. Well, people just need to look at the material that's actually coming to light. She's stolen the nomination. Bernie Sanders should be facing off against Trump, but he's not, because she's stolen the nomination.
Assange has offered a $20,000 reward, £15,000 reward for any information leading to any conviction in the murder of 27-year-old Democratic National Committee staffer Seth Rich. He was the one who was killed earlier this year in suspected attempted robbery, where actually nothing was taken from him, but he was the guy right at the heart of the internet email system that Hillary Clinton seems to be saying was the Russians.
Yes, I mean, it's sinister. It would be laughable if it wasn't so sinister, the kind of thing that she's doing.
Okay, but before we go on to hear from Donald Trump, the wonderful, trying to choose between these two is really not the easiest choice that we can make. It certainly isn't a very democratic choice. There's neocon Robert Kagan spurns the Republican Party and hosts a fundraiser for Hillary Clinton. Now, they call him a neocon, Martin, because back in around about 2000, 2001, he was one of the two main people that set up the neoconservative group. And he's now gone from the Republican Party and he's decided he's going to support Hillary as a Democratic. You do wonder, don't you, if actually the real people running America just switch from party to party, whoever they feel is going to be a better candidate for them. And these are the guys behind the war on terror, and they think Hillary's their person for the presidency.
Yes.
Who is this guy, Robert Kagan?
Well, he's a sort of he's a right-wing neoconservative, as you rightly point out, highly thought of in those circles. He's the husband of Victoria Nuland, she of the famous FDEU fame, who orchestrated the coup against Yanukovych in Ukraine, and they see Hillary Clinton as a safe pair of hands to keep stoking the war fires with Russia and China to the benefit of the US military industrial complex. Very dangerous and very silly, but there you are.
So do you think there's any real choice in this election?
Well, as I said, if Hillary Clinton hadn't stolen the Democratic nomination, which it looks as if she did by basically vote rigging, then it would be Sanders versus Trump. But it's not, is it?
OK, well, let's have a listen now to Donald Trump speaking the day after Hillary Clinton at the American Legion this week.
We are going to end the era of nation building and create a new foreign policy joined by our partners in the Middle East that is focused on destroying ISIS and radical Islamic terrorism. We will extend the hand of friendship to any nation that will work with us in good faith on this vital mission, and we want this mission to be accomplished quickly. At the same time, we will change our immigration screening procedures to help keep terrorists and extremists out of our country. We have enough problems. Our country has enough problems. We don't need that one. And that includes stopping the influx of Syrian refugees. We do not want to let anyone in our country who doesn't support our values and who is not capable of loving our people. It's time to create a new American future for you, your children, and all American children yet to come. In this future, we will have an honest government that includes an honest State Department, not pay for play. She probably didn't mention that to you yesterday. Government access and favors will no longer be for sale, and important email records will no longer be deleted and digitally altered, which is something they just found out 2 days ago. Bleached. Expensive process. Why? 33,000 emails bleached through a very expensive process. You ask yourself, what's going on?
Well, Donald Trump there, clearly Marty making reference to Hillary Clinton's rather damning email trail. But, I mean, you know, what's to say that he's going to be any better?
Well, no, not a lot. I mean, it makes me laugh. He's talking about we are going to fight ISIS. Well, in actual fact, as General Flynn leaked in his report, ISIS was basically facilitated by the U.S. intelligence services. They created them.
One of the people very closely connected with Hillary Clinton is good old Henry Kissinger. He now lives at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York, which, by the way, about a year ago was bought by the Chinese. And very clearly, Kissinger is quite close to the Chinese as well as to the Pentagon. Look, Martin, these two together make quite an interesting combination, don't they? Former Secretary of State Kissinger has presented her with a Distinguished Leadership Award from the Atlantic Council in Washington. Obviously, best buddies, whereas it doesn't seem Trump is quite, although he has met with Kissinger, is quite so close. This is a little bit worrying as we go into our next item, which is to do with Chile's torture commune run by Pinochet's paedophile Nazi pal. This was in last month in the Daily Express. Eric Zotchukas lived through the ordeal in the aftermath of Chile's 1973 military coup, as featured in Emma Watson's new film, The Colony. Blindfolded and strapped to a bed in an underground tunnel, the prisoner braces himself, knowing there will be no escape from the agonising electric shocks about to be inflicted. Now, this was the Pinochet fascist regime put in place by Henry Kissinger in 1973, when he was Secretary of State. But, Martin, one of the hideous things about The Colony was that the interrogation was done by remote control, so those being tortured could never identify the people who were doing the torture.
Yes, sickening, really. And there he is, Henry Kissinger, advising Hillary Clinton, who wants to be President of the United States.
So let's have a listen now to a documentary from the mid-1970s, in fact, just a few years after the coup in Chile. And the person speaking here most of the way through is the CIA former Deputy Director Tom Braden, where he talks a little bit about Watergate and then gets into discussing Allende in 1973 and the coup.
Watergate forced the resignation of Richard Nixon and Howard Hunt was jailed. But the CIA didn't escape the remorseless process of investigation which was set in train. Late last year, the post-Watergate insistence on open government unearthed another damaging episode. The CIA had secretly backed the forces which brought down the left-wing government of President Allende in Chile in 1973. The CIA successfully financed Allende's opponents for 15 years, but in 1970 they miscalculated his support and did little to help the opposition. Allende, a Marxist, won by a small majority in a democratic election. Secretary of State Kissinger was disturbed. With President Nixon's agreement, he ordered an economic freeze on Chile. The CIA also went into action behind the scenes, and in the next 3 years, millions of dollars were spent in efforts to undermine Allende. But before these facts came out, Richard Helms, the CIA's director during the Chile campaign, had testified on oath before Congress that the agency played no part in Allende's downfall.
When he stood up before the Senate to testify, he was asked certain questions about his operations in Chile. He was asked, "Did you spend any money to overthrow the Allende government?" And he said, "No, sir." He asked if he had conducted any covert activities against the Allende government, and he said, "No, sir." And for that, he probably, in the post-Watergate era, will be indicted for perjury. That's a decision we'll learn about in a few weeks. Because shortly after he had made that statement, his predecessor, Colby, went up to Congress and told him the truth.
How did this come about, this turnaround in policy?
Watergate. Richard Helms is going by the old CIA tradition, which is that, if necessary, the director will openly lie.
CIA's involvement in covert action.
In the post-Watergate atmosphere, even secret services aren't allowed secrets. William Colby, the new director of the CIA, had told a congressional committee in strictest confidence how the agency had indeed spent $8 million financing opposition to Allende. So enraged was Congressman Michael Harrington that he leaked Colby's secret testimony to the press and exposed the earlier deception.
I went in prepared to accept the ground rules of secrecy,
But it was obviously at such pronounced variance with what both I had believed and what the American public had been told. I think it was very important, and still do, that in some fashion, preferably without the distraction of how it was released, to get the American public to understand what we did in the context of a country like Chile, not in the mid-50s, but in the early 1970s.
The secret information given to Harrington showed that the CIA's so-called Dirty Tricks Department was active in Chile. First, in a bid to stop the endorsement of Allende, who had scraped home so narrowly, the CIA earmarked $350,000 to bribe Chilean congressmen. That plan failed, and Allende became president. The CIA then set about undermining him. They helped finance demonstrations by middle-class women who beat pots and pans outside Allende's house each day. They also financed more sinister groups, like the right-wing terrorist group Fatherland and Freedom Party, which blew up bridges and radio transmitters and caused riots. But the catalyst that finally paved the way for Allende's overthrow was the one used successfully by the CIA in Guyana 10 years before, a prolonged strike, this time by Chilean lorry owners. 2,700 miles long, Chile is totally dependent on road transport. The result was chaos. The strikers stayed out for 6 weeks, subsidized secretly by the CIA. The chaos of the CIA-backed strike gave Allende's opponents in the Chilean armed forces the excuse they needed. The presidential palace was bombed. Allende died inside it, and 15,000 socialists were murdered by the military regime, now one of the most repressive in Latin America.
I think it was a mistake for us because it was a terrible embarrassment for it to come out. I think we pay for it in shame and in loss of dignity.
Who, in fact, ran the...
Dr. Kissinger ran the Chile operation, very much like a desk officer. He's that way. He likes to do things himself.
Now, Martin, the main point here being that Thomas Braden, deputy director of the CIA, says in that clip is actually that he personally knew that Kissinger ran the entire operation from his desk in the State Department. The overthrow of Allende and the installation of General Pinochet in Chile. I mean, this led to something like 30,000-40,000 people disappeared in that country over a decade.
Yeah, well, it's even worse in Argentina. And, of course, they were behind all of the military governments in Latin America in that era who killed hundreds of thousands of people in the most horrible circumstances. And that's your tax dollars at work, folks.
Okay, we'll have to do astroturfing next week again, I'm afraid, but since it's the beginning of a new school year, a chillingly accurate 200-year-old letter predicts World War III, a final battle against Islam. This is in the Daily Express. The Daily Mail have covered it too. A letter written by American Civil War captain predicted both world wars and a battle with Islam. Albert Pike, who was captain for the US Army during the American Civil War, is said to have written a doctrine to an Italian politician outlining plans for three world wars. The letter plots how and why the First and Second World Wars broke out in the 1900s, provides an even more chilling prophecy over a third and final battle. The Third World War, according to Mr. Pike, will be fought against the West and leaders of the Islamic War. He said it would be the most bloody turmoil. Document revealed by several newspapers, The Mail and The Star, etc., is revealed in various books. Reportedly sent by Pike, a Freemason, to Italian politician Giuseppe Mazzini, and was dated August 15, 1871.
Well, I mean, it's very difficult to predict what's going to happen next week, so plotting a World War 200 years in the future is pretty, you know, I don't really give it that much credence, Tony, I have to say.
Mr. Pike warned the Third World War would be the most bloody turmoil. We shall unleash the nihilists and the atheists. We shall provoke a formidable social cataclysm, which in all its horror will show clearly to the nations the effect of absolute atheism. Origin of savagery in the most bloody turmoil. Now, I mean, whether this is true aside, this does seem to be the sort of thing that's brewing up, a kind of religious war between Zionists and Islam.
Well, you don't have to be a prophet to predict that we may end up having a third world war. And you don't need to read stuff written 200 years ago on spec. It's all staring
okay, well,
in the face,
I'll put a link into the Daily Mail and the Daily Express articles on that anyway, because it's, I think, quite fascinating. Time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 7. Coming up for the next 2 hours, Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi and Kamal. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, Labour Councillor for Bishopston and Ashley Down, Tom Brook. Thisweek.org.uk takes you straight to this show's links and archives, and also you can comment down there too. I'm on Twitter at